Blog Talk Radio.
Veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, former police chief, private investigator and instructor at Boston University, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the Crime Wire team information about an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Susan and Denny have the night off. Vito's going to take over this first case.
Good evening, everybody. We welcome you to our show tonight. Two interesting cases we have for you. And we'll get right to it. The first case we're going to talk about is the very big, high-profile case that's been going on since 2007 up here in Connecticut, in Cheshire, Connecticut. Last Friday, the jury in New Haven, Connecticut, returned a death penalty verdict in the case of the second killer associated with the 2007 home invasion of the Pettit family. Joshua Komarzewski joins his accomplice, Stephen Hayes, on death row for the brutal murder of Dr. William Pettit's wife and two daughters. The jurors were not swayed by the defense argument that Komarzewski's troubled upbringing should have spared him from receiving the death penalty. After we explain this a little bit to our listeners, I'm sure most of you know about this case, but the ones that are not, we want your opinions on the blog, as you think because of his past, he should have been spared the death penalty, or was this the right verdict that was given to him? You know, Tom, I started talking about, it seems like an eternity ago, 2007, when this case broke. I can remember the day this case broke, and I just talked on shows two times a day, one time a day, whatever, for literally a couple of months. So, you know, and you got to think about Dr. Pettit, Dr. William Pettit, the husband in all this, who was probably one blow away from dying himself. That's how bad he was. They didn't even know if he was going to make it. But he has had to live over the last 4.5 years with two trials, two death penalty hearings, and, you know, now that is over with, at least that part of it. Now, there may be additional hearings coming up to try to get these death penalty charges overthrown, which will be very, very doubtful because, quite honestly, the absolute magnitude of this case rivals anything else that has ever happened in the last 50, 60 years in our country. Just to let our listeners know, it was an amazing case. Joshua Komarzewski and his accomplice, Stephen Hayes, did a home invasion on the Pettit family house back in 2007, at which time they proceeded to give Dr. William Pettit an unbelievable beating, left him for dead. He literally crawled on his hands and knees with his last ounce of strength to get to a neighbor's house. Meanwhile, the subjects killed Dr. Pettit's wife and the two daughters. the two daughters, one by the name of Michaela, which was age 11 at the time, Haley, who was 17, and, of course, the wife, Jennifer Hawk Pettit. The details of the case were unbelievable as to what they did. They raped the women. This is including the girls. They set them on fire. They took pictures of the victims after they raped them. There was an excitefulness about what they were doing as they were taking pictures, things of that nature. And it was, burned them and smoked them to death. I mean, it was just absolutely incredible of the magnitude of what was done. So much so, ladies and gentlemen, that surveys were taken out in the street of the New Haven courthouse as to, they wanted to talk to people that were against the death penalty, and they found people that were against the death penalty, and they asked them if they were familiar with this case going on at the time. And so many people stated the following, that they were against the death penalty their entire life, don't believe in it at all, don't believe there should be a death penalty. But I don't know how many dozens of people that, independent of each other, answered and said, but these two men need to get the death penalty. It was one of those aha moments when you hear an explanation like that, that people that 40, 50, 60 years may have been against the death penalty that says, you know, I'm against it, but, you know, give these guys the death penalty because this kind of rises above everything else. That's what type of a case it is. Before I turn it over to Tom on it, I've often spoke on television. I said this, you know, it's like apples and oranges to try to say, well, one case is worse than another one. But what I always explain on television, that it rivals the Tate-LaBianca Manson murders back then in the many, many years ago, as well as the famous Clutter family out in Kansas that were famous, that murder was made famous in the book and the movie In Cold Blood, Truman Capote's book. Those are the only two that came to mind to me that could even rival it. And before I turn it to Tom, I was asked by Joy Behar on her show, well, Vito, how do you rate it against like Manson's thing and everything? And I said to her, Joy, you can't pick out, this is like picking out a top five of cases. You can't. They're all independent of each other. But I said to her, this case stands on its own. This case stands on its own as far as brutality. And also when they were questioning these people on the street, they told people to give them one word, explain this murder case in one word. And by far the one word that was used the most was just people looked at the person and said, evil. That's the only word I can think of, ma'am or sir, evil. So, Tom, what can you say about this case? It's you know, you can't even say it's over for Dr. Pettit. You know why? Because here's a man that went from a house full of people to one person himself going home now every night, if he's still even in that house, I have no idea, but whatever house he's in, you know, even, I've said this to people, even if one kid stayed alive, at least he would have somebody that he could go home to as far as out of the three. But, you know, he goes from a wife and two children to a house of nobody. So, Tom, what do you feel about this whole thing now that this part of it is done?
Well, that was a great overview for our listeners, and I have to tell you, it's quite a shocking case in my own lifetime, in my professional experience. I'd never seen or heard of any depravity that really rivals this. And let me just read a quick statement from Komisarzewski's own family, and it's this, quote, from the very beginning, we have spoken out about the horror of the crime and taken the position that whatever verdict the jury reached was the right verdict. And they're now talking about the death penalty phase. With today's jury decision, our view is the same. The crime was monstrous and beyond comprehension. There are no excuses. I mean, and that I think that says it all for a lot of people. Here's his own family. You know what really is troublesome when things like this occur? It affects so many people. I mean, it didn't. Yes, it affected these victims. Look what it did to even this man's own family. Before he went and perpetrated this crime, he put his 9-year-old daughter to bed, and she actually was videotaped responding to questions that I think the jury observed during the penalty decision phase. And again, if there was one case that that is probably emblematic for why this punishment is really necessary, it's this case. I remember hearing you when watching you on a variety of shows. I remember being on Nancy Grace and really even being myself just dumbfounded as to how to explain. Well, Tom, what went on here? Nancy would ask. I think unconscionable, intolerable, and reprehensible. I've never seen anything like it. And again, the case does stand on its own. And I'm sure that there'll be a Sunday night movie. There'll be a book, and the it'll be out there on the landscape until the next massacre occurs. And that's why, as a former cop, I preach to people, you have to exercise crime prevention around your home. And these poor people, they were vulnerable, and they just were unfortunately in, the wrong place at the wrong time where these two wackos got them. And this can happen in any neighborhood. This was an upscale neighborhood.
Right. Oh, yeah. This is a town, a very, very safe, high-end town, very high-end town in Connecticut, where I don't know, I forgot how many years since there was any even type of a crime along this line of a felony charge. But what's interesting, Tom, the first trial of Stephen Hayes went pretty quickly, pretty smooth. He was given the death penalty. There wasn't much fighting in that. But the attorneys that Komar Zjeski had on his case, they were fighting from the beginning. Before the trial even started, they complained to the judge about when they watched the first trial that the audience, meaning the TV and radio people and the journalists from all over the country that filled the courthouse, they saw them twittering, okay? And they said, well, that's not right. They shouldn't be twittering in there. And the judge, said that was fine. They're twittering. They're doing their work. They're calling their newspaper. They're writing their newspaper or whatever. So they started off by that. But one of the most horrific things that I think was done by the defense attorneys in this case was as the trial was going on. Now this is as far as the trial, when they showed the in-depth pictures of the crime scene and the victims. And what was left of the victims, Tom? The whole Pettit family had gotten up from their whole row, all en masse. Now, anybody that's listening to our show, our people, and you and me, Tom, can understand that you can't sit there, I don't know how, no matter how strong you want to be, and say, I'm going to support my wife and kids, I'm going to sit here, and they're not going to make me get up. But at some point, when you see a totally burnt beyond recognition body or whatever it may be of your naked child and things like that, they all got up. And you know what the defense attorneys did? They yelled and screamed. They yelled and screamed that, oh, my God, this is prejudice. Do you see what they did right in the middle of the trial? Everybody on the jury looked at them. They're not going to pull this again. I'm telling you, they're not going to pull this again. I mean, it was the most ridiculous statement that anybody can say. That went all over the country that day, and what they were trying to accomplish, I have no idea, Tom, but they're putting it out there like it was a prejudicial thing, how they all planned this maybe. They all said, let's get up, make a big exit here. I mean, what a ridiculous statement to make, and saying, this won't happen again. I'm not going to allow this to happen again for my client. I mean, what do you think about that, Tom?
Well, before I reply to that, we've got a caller that called in from 860 area code. Hello, you're on.
Yes, good evening, Tom and Vito. This is Lady Justice from Imagine Publicity.
How you doing?
Lady D?
Donna Gore calling.
Donna. How are you, Donna?
Donna, I'm doing fine. Thank you, Vito. I wanted to just call in and kind of put my two cents in because I happen to know Dr. Pettit personally.
Sure.
And have been very supportive, and maybe I can add a little bit to the conversation.
Please do.
Okay. You just brought up the fact that you weren't sure what he was doing and where he was living. And, in fact, he is living in Plainville, in the town that he was brought up in his home with his elderly parents and his 96 or so year old grandmother. And he has a room there. And, in fact, I think it was in June or July, they did a big article in GQ magazine. And he explained how he is staying there in order to help his elderly parents out and his grandparent. And it gets to be a little trying sometimes because they're all very much hearing impaired and all the TVs are blaring and going at once. And he kind of goes off to his little bedroom and operates the Pettit Family Foundation from his room there. So it's definitely not the optimal living situation, but for now I think it's a transitional one and one that he feels that he has to do. But I believe that I think he probably is on the precipice of perhaps making some other decisions in his life. The way I happen to know him personally is that I work for a state agency in Connecticut for the blind, and two or three years ago, we do an awards event that's kind of like the Emmy Awards for blind people, and I was the chairperson, and him being an endocrinologist and diabetes expert, I thought he would be a wonderful person to do this, and he was very, very gracious and was wonderful, a wonderful MC. And got to know him, you know, as a result of that, and have known him ever since, and have, you know, written a couple of pieces on him on my website, and I just can't tell you what a gracious man he is. He's an academic, but he's been thrown into the limelight, and I believe that, you know, that in and of itself can change your life. So he has become more of a people person. He, you know, not quite as reserved and quiet as he used to be, but he perpetually gives back even in this state of tragedy. And I speak this too because I am a homicide survivor. My father was murdered in Hartford 30 years ago. And so we did have that commonality in mind in common. And I try to do everything to promote his foundation as well. And as you know, Vito, there's a lot of fundraising perpetually going on with the foundation. I also lived in his town in Cheshire several years ago. And it is an affluent community. It's a small community, but again, any town where something as horrific as this would happen would change the topography forever, I think. And I just don't know how he has withstood everything with, like I say, with such grace and always thinking about maintaining the honor of his family and always helping others in their memory. And I think this is going to continue to go on, whether he chooses to continue as a doctor or not. I think he may have some other options, but the foundation also has three different missions. You know, one, to promote women in science, because his daughter was going to be a doctor as well, to promote people have had violence in the family, and of course MS. And I also work with a number of colleagues who also have MS, because his wife had MS, and his daughters, before they passed on, did a number of projects in their mom's memory. You know, Michaela's Garden, They started their own MS chapters. This family was very community oriented and always gave back and did many, many things to help other people long before this happened. So I'll,
that's amazing, Donna. Thank you for that input. That really adds a lot to somebody that's actually met him, lived near him the whole bit. He, Dr. Pettit has carried himself magnificently through this four-and-a-half-year, I can't say enough about him, his demeanor at court. I had a noted psychologist on my show one time, maybe about a year and a half ago, 2 years, to just kind of pick her brain about what's going on in Dr. Pettit's mind. What does he need to do? Now, you know, for everybody mourns and gets over things in their own way, but, you know, I can't imagine. I'm sure there had to be times where you wake up in the middle of the night, you're all by yourself now, and it's kind of like, oh, my God, my kids died probably wondering, where's Daddy? You know, mm-hmm. My wife was saying, where's my husband? Where is he? He'll save us. You know, it's a thing that, you know, we can guess on this show. Us and everybody on the blog, we could only guess as to the magnitude of what this guy has endured. You know, he was probably, like I said at the beginning, one blow away from dying himself. That's how really beaten he was.
Right.
You know, and that type of thing. Donna, before we click off with you, I want you, I saw your, a couple of your sites yesterday. I want you to reach out to me, either Facebook or Twitter or something, and on the side, give me your telephone number, because I want to talk to you about another show, okay?
Okay, so that'd be wonderful. So, thank you so much.
All right, yeah, definitely. But thank you for calling in. You added a lot, being somebody that actually knows more of the, you know, the stuff of what's going on with him. Thank you very much, Donna.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Vito.
Thank you.
Thank you for your contribution.
Okay, yes, take care. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
You know, Tom, so much, I mean, every pundit, every whatever you want, you know, you want to call us talking heads, you want to call us legal commentators, everyone has talked about this for 4.5 years, and it's always with a sense of amazement and horror. And I've heard many people that are good talkers on these shows have to pause for a minute and say, I really don't know what to say right now, and move on, try to move on to say something about it, you know? It's just, it's amazing. Now, before we run out of time on this segment, Tom, if I can, a lot has been talked about in these hearings about Komisar Jeske's growing up period. Now, now, here's the dilemma. Here's the whole dilemma in a nutshell, okay? It was brought up, and it was documented and everything else, that he had himself a pretty horrific childhood, okay? Now, I'm not standing here to vouch for him. I just want to lay something out there so we
factually
all understand.
Yep.
Right, factual stuff. He was beaten. He was sexually abused numerous times. His family never took the action of doing anything. I think they heard from everybody, of all other people back there that knew the situation, be it through a church or be it through schools or whatever. Now, the dilemma happens here, Tom, in society is, okay, sure, the man had a horrific life. It messed him up. It screwed him up royally. But what do you do then with an individual that goes out, becomes a criminal, and commits a crime that's even 100% worse than what happened to him? You see, because the whole thing is society needs to be safe from people of this nature. Now, you know, you could feel a twinge of what happened to him years ago, okay? And I'm not heartless here. I believe in the death penalty, and I said before the hearings ever happened that I still believe that they both needed the death penalty. All I'm trying to do is, that's the problem that happens in here. When you have, let's say when you have inner city kids, be it white or black, and they grow up, and they think in their mind, the only way I can get money from mommy is I have to hold up the liquor store. And then they wind up shooting the liquor store guy and murdering. They're away for their life. See, there's always, for a lot of people, there's always a legitimate reason in their mind why they did it. But the bottom line, Tom, is you have to take care of these criminals. They can't roam the street and kill your family and kill my family.
Absolutely right. Listen, last year, day after Christmas, here in Woburn, Massachusetts, which is just outside of Boston, again, somebody on parole, a fellow who had had a terrible criminal history, was released, and he shot and killed Officer John McGuire, a guy that I actually knew. And McGuire's death resulted in a complete overhaul of how Massachusetts parole works. Actually, the entire parole board was dismissed by our governor because of the outrage that this guy never should have been on the street. That's for sure. And here again, you know, what is Connecticut doing? Have they clamped down? You know, that's the issue here. How do you regulate this stuff? How do we identify them early on? And again, we continue to, as a society, generate these kinds of horrible people who mete out this incredible, you know, brutality. And you know, we have to prepare ourselves for this. And parole, it's necessary, but, you know, when you get these guys, I mean, I don't know what these two knuckleheads were thinking. If they wanted to just rob this woman after they take it to the bank and then, you know, just leave her. But no, they go this extra step, and it's, I'm not, you know, a heartless individual, but when I heard this, it was, you know, I said, this is a death penalty. I mean, there's no other resolution for this case, for this outcome.
No, definitely not. No, without a doubt. I mean, you know, no matter the upbringing, no matter what happened to him or anybody else mentally, the whole bottom line is these people can't roam society. Okay, they can't roam society and continue. Now, let's say Hayes and Komisarjewski got away with this and never got caught. Okay, they've already got the taste and the magnitude of a horrific burglary. They got the spoils from it. In other words, meaning whatever money, whatever jewelry, the sexual satisfaction that they said that they got from this, putting it on film and everything like that. So you know yourself, they're going to strike and strike other times too. That wouldn't have been a one-time deal for them. So it is what it is. Connecticut hasn't had a death penalty situation, haven't put anybody to death in decades. Okay, so it shows you how strong. When the defense attorneys went in before the trials even started, just for a hearing maybe with the prosecutors, they were told, we're not entertaining anything, no, nothing at all, no plea bargain, no nothing. So, I mean, if you're in here for that, please walk out the door, because this is a trial all the way, and no, this is a death penalty all the way, and I don't care about, you know, 400 years, give their client so he never gives out or whatever it may be. No, this ain't going to work that way. And that's how set up, that's how hopped up on this they all were, Tom, you know, from the beginning. But I tell you, the tri-state area, which we have here, which is New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, this, every place I went, and people knowing that, you know, I'm an ex-cop and on TV, every single person, Vito, what do you think about the Cheshire case? Oh, my God. That's all I heard over and over again. Having guests on my show from California, any place out there, they all familiar with this. Having Ann Bremner from Seattle, Washington, very familiar with the case. I mean, over and over again, this case was, you know, infamous. And I'm glad Donna called in, because there's somebody that knows a little bit more about how he's doing, where he's at, and things of that nature. It's going to be a long process for him, the psychologists have said. It's going to be a long process.
True. And the fact that, as Donna indicated, that he has somewhat of a network right now, you know, that his family needs him. In terms of the crisis situation, at least he's able to focus on, you know, I mean, somebody needs him. Can you imagine if he didn't have extended members in his family, what, you know, how that would eat at you? I don't know that I'd be able to continue on.
They filled up the rows a lot of times. They were there. His sister was on his arm a lot of times. You know, it was amazing support. And, you know, none of us, you, me, Tom, anybody that's listening, anybody walking the streets, none of us can ever guess how we would react if we were Dr. Pettit. You see, we can't. We think in our mind we can, but we can't even fathom what type of reaction we would have.
True. And you know, you mentioned that his family had difficulty looking at the photographs that were displayed to the jurors. You and I have been, exposed to that. We're inoculated. Mm-hmm. But now that's a very typical response. Family members, even when there are no photographs, when even at the preliminary stages of a prosecution, when the prosecutor is rendering, just the facts through an oral presentation, family members crumble and they have to leave. I mean, it's the ultimate infliction of pain to a human being, and to have to, to see that. And again, this man survived it. I can just imagine the survivor's guilt that goes along with this.
Yeah, when the trials were actually going on, I remember a woman was so sick that she didn't sleep for days. Okay, now when this death penalty thing happened on Komisar Jeske, when they also played, Tom, they also played a tape from his 9-year-old daughter that kind of pleaded for his life, so to speak. Okay,
yep.
And the jurors, not that they were torn, they were headed towards the death penalty anyway, but they were so messed up by this. When they spoke to jurors afterwards, one guy says, "I'm just going home, and I'm not going to do anything for days. I can't go to work, and I don't want visitors. I just have to be by myself for a while." Imagine that, how this affected
him. Now, decompress.
Yeah. Now, to offset. Now, the defense figured, I guess, or whatever, that let's have his daughter talk, which was ridiculous to put a child through this, a videotape statement about her dad. Okay, I think it was horrible, but maybe she'll spare him the death penalty and get him life in prison. And some of the reasons, the crazy reasons, is that, he's still my father. I'm 9 years old. I'll be going into my formative years, whatever. And maybe just somehow, even though he's in jail for the rest of his life, that can help me. But what people don't realize now, that sounds like an interesting statement, but you have to look at the reality of this. First of all, he's going to be alive, like they just said the other day on the news, for decades yet to come with appeals.
Yeah.
Okay? Public needs to understand he's not being killed next week or next year or 2 years from now. They're talking at least 2 decades from now it's going to take before he's killed. All right? The 9-year-old girl will be married, having children. She'll be, past her formative years and hopefully living a life where she's fine. So, you could put that to rest. He's still going to be around anyway. Now, in saying that, put my dad in jail for the rest of his life, there's a realistic thing, and we've talked about this before on other cases. There's no way that he is going to stay alive in a prison. Biggest case in the country, prison has their own rules. You're going to get somebody that wants an honor badge at prison that's going to kill him 3 years from now, 5 years from now, if he was sentenced to life. Okay? That's just how it would have been for somebody like him. They would think about their daughters. The prisoners would think about their mother. They would think about people like that, and they would kill him. If somebody's in prison and they're serving life anyway, they don't care about killing somebody else. What else is going to happen to them? You see? So, I mean, I don't really think he would have lasted too long. And, the protective custody, now he's on death row, so I think he's a little more protected than if he was at some other prison. Do you agree what I'm saying, that this would have taken years and years?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There'll be penalty reviews and so on and so forth, but, they have to be in lockdown. You're right. They're going to get it from all sides. They'll get it from the staff, they'll get it from other inmates. Again, as you alluded to, who are looking to enhance their own street cred inside the facility. And again, there's nothing more, more loathsome in jail than somebody that does something to a child. And, this 9-year-old was there. And, I can just imagine the jurors saying, well, does this fella value life if he raped a girl 2 years older than his daughter.
Right.
You know what I mean? So what kind of
filmed her and set her on fire. Filmed her and set her on fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine what kind
I mean,
of death that is as you're tied up in bed and you're, and the gasoline is poured and you're set on fire. Oh, come on. And you've already screwed up because the man has already raped you and taken pictures of you. And, I mean, you know, I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable because this, I can't, you know, again, I can't, I know we started the show by saying this, but to me, I've been involved in police work or PI work since 1969, and I've worked some of the biggest cases, as you have too, Tom, across the country, and this one needs no PR agent to promote it. This stands on its own.
Yeah, again, the fact that this knucklehead took a picture of that child that he had raped, I mean, I don't know. How do you explain
that? You can't.
That?
You can't.
And our
listeners are stunned by it. They're making their comments. We're making our comments. But you can't really grasp it, you know? And I'm glad it's over. I'm glad this man doesn't have to go to court anymore. 4.5 years he's had to sit there and endure and listen over and over the details of, well, now I did this, and then he did that to her, and then Michaela had this happen to her, and then the mother, what's her name, Jennifer Hawke, had this happen to her, you know, and Haley, who was 17, then this was done to her. I mean, 4.5 years, Tom, of hearing this. This is unreal, absolutely unreal.
It is. It'll be an interesting book. Again, all of the details of how, you know, Mrs. Pettit was, you know, there at the bank, and she had reported it, and she's walking out, and the police are summoned, and while they're setting up, doing what I think was the, you know, the appropriate response, their people are in place, they're waiting for a team of tactical equipped officers to respond. Then poof, they see the smoke, and these two knuckleheads drive away, and they're captured immediately.
Right.
It's incredible. But are you ready to move on?
Sure. Sure.
All right. All right. Here's our second case. Another knucklehead, by the way. last week, a federal judge sentenced former Governor Rod Blagojevich of Illinois to 14 years in jail for corruption. The disgraced governor had been convicted for trying to sell President Obama's vacant U.S. Senate seat. At the sentencing, federal judge James Zagel said, quote, "The abuse of the office of governor is more damaging than the abuse of any other office except the president's," end quote. And sadly, Vito, over the last decade, corruption scandal has consumed a long list of governors across this country. Let's tonight examine some of the contributing factors that lead to corruption. Let's start by examining the sordid mix of ego and greed that toppled Governor Blago. What a knucklehead here. Here's a guy who all along maintained, you know, during that first trial, before the trial, you know, wanted to get on, what was it, Survivor? You know, was out there, and he was, you know, I didn't do anything. And then, he's found guilty in the second trial, and then he suddenly is like, well, you know, I'm really sorry now. you know, it's disgusting. Now, let's just stick with Illinois here for a little bit. The immediate predecessor, George Ryan, is still serving a 6.5-year stretch in federal prison for racketeering and fraud. In 1973, another governor, a Democrat, Otto Kerner, was convicted, spent 3 years in the federal pen for conspiracy, perjury, and other corruption charges. Back in 1987, Dan Walker was convicted. He was convicted for bank fraud. And yet still a fourth one, Lennington Small, a Republican who served back in the 20s, was indicted while in office for embezzlement. from actions that he had done when he was the state treasurer. Locally, you know, I don't want to pick on your state because I'll talk about my state here in a minute, but Connecticut's John Rowland resigned in 2004 and served 10 months in prison for accepting gifts from state contractors lying about it. In fact, that same year, you may remember this, Vito, James McGreevy resigned as New Jersey's governor after admitting to an affair with another man
we lost all three governors of the whole tri-state area, Governor Rowland in my state, Governor Spitzer in New York, and McGreevy in New Jersey, the whole tri-state area. Now, and you're not too far. You're semi-tri-state. you're off of that a little bit. And it's this absolute power thing. Okay, you're the governor. You're the biggest person in the state. You have unbelievable power. So they think that they can never get caught in whatever they do. You know,
and then the poor
wives have to stand next to them when they do their president. I mean, Blago thought that he could just go on shows, and he was all over TV, MSNBC, Fox News, CNN, talking away on shows like anything. And then what did he say last week when he was sentenced, Tom? He says, when he spoke before the judge at the sentencing, I really didn't realize that this was illegal, what I did.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, my God. Your Honor, I'm telling you, you found me guilty. But I didn't know it was illegal to do all that stuff. I mean, imagine that. You go out in style like that.
Well, that's true. And don't forget Governor Mark Sanford down in South Carolina last year. He had used funds from his state to go and maintain a relationship with a woman in Argentina. But listen, here in Massachusetts, and this just happened last month, our third consecutive Speaker of the House of Representatives. Now, that's like the third most powerful elected officer in the state. He is serving, he just got sentenced to 8 years in Kentucky, in the federal pen down there, for corruption. His immediate predecessor pled guilty to obstruction of justice and some corruption. He lost his law license. He's out on the street. And the one right before that, Charles Flaherty, he was indicted, found guilty of tax evasion. And again, you talk about they're impervious to any kind of oversight. And it's, you know, the ego, which you talked about with Rod. Blago got out there. I mean, that pure ego. He's out there. And you know, they're doing it for personal gain or personal power. And, I see the same thing, and I think you have too, with cops. They start out, and, you know, you've heard the analogy before, the meat eater versus the grass eater.
Right. Yep. Yep.
The grass eater is the person that, you know, they're out there. And this is true, you know, anybody that's out there, you know, whether it's a cop, whether it's a politician, and no matter what level, they take a free coffee. And then eventually, you know, they do something else that goes along, and not, instead of being a grass eater because of the peer pressure, hey, kid, you got to take the free food, you know, don't upset anything here. And then suddenly when they have that power, it's like, you know something? And when I listen to those tapes of Blago talking with his brother, talking about, hey, this is effing unbelievable. This is really good. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, my God. You know, to hear him that, you know, that I've got the power and I'm going to do what I want to do. It was, you know, again, you and I are veteran cynics because of, you know, the way we've worked professionally. But for the average citizen, I think it was an eye-opener when, you know, hearing Blago, you know, talk like that, it's that kind of raw, naked power. Now, there's something on cable now that I have been watching. And I highly recommend it to our listeners. He's Kelsey Grammer, who we knew as Frasier, okay?
Yep.
He plays a marvelous, malevolent, calculating political boss in a series called Boss. And he portrays a mayor in what state? Illinois. What city? Chicago.
Right.
It's really good. To see Kelsey Grammer, I mean, he really, he's the personification of evil. He's had people whack. It's a mixture of the Sopranos and Boardwalk Empire.
Right.
It's just political stuff. And we don't generally talk about this kind of abuse of authority on Crime Wire. Typically, we're talking about misuse of authority by cops who fail
yep.
to investigate, things like that. But, you know, I think this is an interesting topic because it's, as that quote I read from the federal judge, that it's the, they're like little presidents, these governors.
Oh, it's amazing. Let me say something about Governor Eliot Spitzer from New York State a minute. If any of our listeners after the show or whenever go on my Facebook, they'll see an interview that my good buddy Gracie Full James posted when I did Bill O'Reilly's show. And Bill O'Reilly couldn't get over, like, Eliot Spitzer. And I said on the show, I said, you know what's so amazing about this Spitzer case? He goes to madams, he goes to prostitutes. Not the same one every time. So, he's got this girl one time, another girl. He deals with another madam. Then he has a couple more. Now, I said on O'Reilly, did he actually think in his mind, every single person that he was with knows who he is. He's the girls are told, this is Governor Eliot Spitzer coming in tonight, whatever. He's a great customer of ours and the whole bit. Now, what I said on the show was, did he actually think that nowhere down the line someone's going to drop a dime on him because they have in their back pocket the governor, which means that if they're ever arrested on something, a larceny, a burglary, and they want to talk to the arresting officers and say, look, can you talk to the prosecutor for me? I have no record. Maybe you could help me out if I give you something big. Well, what do you got to give us? Eliot Spitzer, he frequents all of our houses here of ill repute, this and that. The whole thing. I mean, where's his mindset for somebody that was such a tough, tough guy like he was against crime? And everything? Did he really think in his mind that he can have dozens and dozens of women and nobody at any time down the road, a year, 6 months, was gonna say his name? That boggles my mind, Tom. It's amazing.
Well, I mean, in the not too distant past, there was a governor from the South who became president. He was using his state troopers to go and get girls.
Right. Yep. Now, see, what Spitzer was doing, as you know, governors have a big security detail that's with them all the time, every place they go. So Spitzer would stay in hotels, wherever he had to go to, of course. And let's say that they would be on the fourth floor of a hotel, and his security guys, his top, usually their state police top guys that are outside the doors and just protecting him all times. He would say to them, I'm going up to the fifth floor. And they say, okay, we'll come with you, Governor. No, I'll be up there for hours. I'm okay. I'll catch you guys later. Now, again, even with his own people, don't you think they know, well, wait a minute, we're in a different city. Who's he know on the fifth floor that he's going to disappear to for hours? So, I mean, the man just left himself so wide open to one person. All he needed was one person just to blow the whistle on him. And it's just a stupidity factor here.
Well, it's felony stupidity, but it's also this hubris that that there's a bubble around them and that nothing is going to penetrate. I mean, they're arrogant. They're drunk with power, and yet then when they get caught, like here, our speaker Sal DeMacy, who said I didn't do anything wrong. I mean, that's federal law. I just don't understand that. And so he gets convicted, and he tells the judge, oh, please, I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. And he says out in front of the court after, he's going to get sentenced. He says, I really didn't do anything wrong. That's federal law. I the state law says I can do that. So when he went back in the court weeks later, the judge said, where in state law does it say that you can bilk people? And so now, he cried. DeMacy cried, you know, he didn't want to get sentenced, so, you know, spare me. Same thing with Blago. When they get caught, you know, you sit there and you watch them. The high and mighty, boy, do they fall hard.
Well, that's for sure. And it's too bad, because these are the people that really clobber the average citizen. Okay, when they put pressure on the average citizen, even if the average citizen is not really breaking the law, they make them feel like you're going to go away for 20 years, you need to do this and that. And because, see, I've always said the phrase, when people don't have any accountability, they have nothing to worry about. I mean, who's over the governor of a state like New York, really, when you think about it, okay? But yet, these people don't realize there's agencies out there, all types of agencies that would love to collar somebody like a governor of that state, providing they have the right information. That's a, you know yourself, Tom, that's a career case for an FBI guy, for whoever, for an attorney general, for whoever in that state. That's a career thing. I arrested my governor. I was part of a team that arrested my governor for wrongdoing.
Oh, sure.
So, I mean, you know, they may think they have absolute power. Okay, because it seems that way, because nobody's higher than me. I'm the governor. The state police report to me. This one reports to me. Everybody has to ask me what to do on a daily basis. But they don't realize you make a lot of enemies, okay? 50% of the people that are working in high places like you, and the other 50% don't like you. So all you need is to have some law enforcement officials of a high level that will take that information. They'll glean that information, use it, and go after the party involved. And that's how it is. But these guys, like you said, now look at Blago. Blago was just plain out of his mind. I mean, you know, he walks down the street and you hear the Deliverance theme song playing as he walks down the street. I mean, that's how bad this guy is. He's just totally out of his... I mean, you know, it's horrible. So I don't get it. How do they even get to these positions?
Well, apathy in the ranks of voters. You know, I don't know. We're not a politically oriented show, but you know, we elect these people, and you know, look at members of Congress that have gone away recently. You know, again, here in Massachusetts, we've had a couple of congressmen. This past year, we had a couple of state senators abuse their power and wind up in jail. It
transcends all party lines, too, just like you said. It don't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, and nobody can stand here and says, well, it's more of this kind than the other. Baloney. It transcends all party lines. That's for sure.
Hey, Dean Beers just posted something in the chat room. Boy, this is humorous. In Chicago, and I've heard this before, they vote more than once and don't have to be alive to vote.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Chicago started the phrase. Chicago really did start the phrase, vote early and often.
Yeah.
I mean, on election days. They're the ones that started it back in the Al Capone time. Vote early and often. So.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, with the remaining 6 or 7 minutes left, how about just a quick update on Sandusky?
It's Sandusky, ladies and gentlemen. If you're living on Mars, you don't know what the case is about. This is Penn State, the assistant coach at Penn State, just like Bernie Fine over at Syracuse. And every day when I pick up the New York Post or the New York Daily News, there's somebody else across the country. It's amazing. I said to people yesterday on a show, when, think about it, you're an assistant coach of Penn State, one of the prime football programs for decades, and the kids that come to the game or somehow meet the coaches and the players, you're the assistant coach. You could say to that 10-year-old kid, hey, who's your favorite player? Oh, my God, I'd love to meet so-and-so. Love him. Fine. How about if I get a football for you? How about if I get him to sign it for you? And you could stay over and then maybe even tomorrow see if he's busy for lunch and the three of us can go. See, that's the power that they have. And not only that, the kid looks, this is a coach. This is a coach here, okay? He's part of running this whole program. So they are ready have gotten in on the kids just by using those approaches, okay? And like a guest I had on yesterday, criminal profiler Pat Brown, and she says they, like a lot of people know, they pick out the weakest individuals or the ones they know they can get over on to do these type of things that will really do anything for the sense of I want to hang out with all these people, even the assistant coach. And it's a shame because that number, I think it was 40 at one time, I think that's continuing to grow. There was a hearing today that
yep.
all the camera crews from across the country thought some of the victims were going to be there and possibly speaking and doing different things like that. But the defense lawyer who was on his way out of court said, well, it was a defense tactic that we used today, which means what they did was got a continuance, got it put off for a while, and just kind of moved on with that. Am I right, Tom?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it's sad because these victims were there prepared to relive and convey, you know, the pain that they experienced at this preliminary hearing. And then now, you know, it's, oh, sorry, we don't need you today. Why didn't they just spare them and tell them, you know, you don't have to come in? Why get them all, you know, anxious and, you know, right before the, you know, this thing is short circuit. It was really a stunt as far as I'm concerned. They had, as you said, 30 trucks, everybody across the country, and they really did their own press conference. And they're trying to humanize him. But Sandusky, I think, is, again, this is another knucklehead, you know, again, major felony stupid here, who is the poster boy of, you know, what's wrong with, you know, with the system here. There's a guy who generates his own foundation, grooms the kids. I'm sure that's what Pat Brown would say. Groom them. And again, who is going to challenge the ego and the power that this man had?
That's right. Absolutely. But, you know, the truth will come out on it. It's definitely, and it's just a shame because one of the, I can't call them kids anymore, one of the people that are now in their late 20s who was supposed to go there today and went, I guess, and found out that it was postponed, said that he was looking at today as the worst day in his life because he thought that he was going to have to be out in the public and, you know, do that whole bit. Now he has to prepare for the next time, you know?
Yeah. Well, the and how about the one down in Westport? What's going on with the Pickering?
Well, it seems like he's getting his own fan club of the parents in the town of Westport that are backing him. This is a coach, another coach close to home here. It's happened all over the country that gave porn site information to all of his freshmen ball players. Okay, now we're talking freshman high school ball. This is high school now we're talking about. These are 14 and 15 year old boys. He thought the boys weren't getting along, weren't as close as they could be on the team. Maybe there was some friction, there wasn't this stuff. So he kind of said, hey, gonna give you guys all the links to all these different porn things, and allegedly, and you know, enjoy yourself, and you guys hang out together and eat popcorn and do whatever, and you know, enjoy. And you know, you got the town split. You got half the people saying, oh, please, he's a great guy. He'd give you the shirt off his back. Well, it's a little pun there, I guess, in there someplace. But and then the other half are saying, he did what to my kid? My kid's 14 years old. What the heck's he, right does he got to do something like that? So, you know, I've been following it in the local papers, and I have to laugh because it's just so stupid. I mean, you know what? I mean, and these guys try to explain it, too, in the press, in the media. I mean, look at Sandusky. Sandusky went on worldwide television and said what? Sure, I shower with boys. Sure, I really adore young boys. They're really great. I don't have any, I don't want to have sex with them. But, you know, I touch their legs sometimes. And his lawyer allowed him or orchestrated it to allow him to go on shows and say these ridiculous things. So it goes on and on, Tom. It goes on and on and on.
I know. It's just a crazy case. Maybe we'll pick up on more of this on either your show again or back here on Crime Wire. And, well, why don't we kind of wrap it up?
Yep, definitely. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Really interesting show. We're going to be doing a lot more shows like this. We're going to be taking topics that are right in the news as we speak. We're going to be discussing a lot of these things. We want your input. We want to see your comments online. But thanks to the Crime Wire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, and public relations team at Imagine Publicity, our next show will be Tuesday, December 20th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume of your computer and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Tom Shamshak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you, and God bless.
Good night,
everybody.
Good night.